Are we live? Oh, I didn't hear my music. Well, welcome to the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. We're always brought to you courtesy of Republic Broadcasting and globalresearch.ca, the website, and the Center of Research on Globalization. Very proud to be associated with it. We have a fine program today in the first hour from London. I have a very distinguished journalist, a man I've admired for many, many years, read many of his books, John Pilger. John, I don't know if we've connected with you yet. Are you on? Oh, don't have him yet. Okay. Well, let me tell listeners who he is, and we'll pick up whenever I can connect with John. He's 6 hours ahead of us in London. John has been an award-winning journalist and a documentary filmmaker since 1958, 50 years. And his achievements, I think we'd need a considerable amount of time to enumerate. He's been a foreign and a war correspondent, an author of 10 books. He's a critic of U.S. Imperial policy and adventurism, foreign wars especially. And he believes that a journalist's job, this is his quote, a journalist's job, first of all, is to look in the mirror of his own society and report on it accurately. Unfortunately, too few journalists do it, but John certainly is one who has done it magnificently for decades. Ah, John, I just finished introducing you. We're connected on now.
Okay, I'm here, Steve.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful. I would just... carry on until I was able to connect with you.
Okay.
I just told listeners a little bit about you and what you've been doing for the past 50 years, and it's a great honor for me to come on and have a discussion with you. We've got about a minute, and we'll take a break, but we can talk about current happenings, world and national. A couple of your articles that I've read. I read all the ones that I can spot. But there's so much going on, John, whether it's the struggle in the caucuses, whether it's the political goings-on here. We just finished both political conventions.
Yeah.
You've written about Barack Obama back in the spring. Maybe we can talk about that a little bit. I just put out an article today wrapping up both conventions, John, and my article was called Vying to be Toughest. I think they're both trying to prove who is the meanest, nastiest guy on the block.
Absolutely, from
all those bad guys out there.
I agree with that, yes. Well, I'll be happy to talk about all that, Steve. Yeah.
Well, people who think Obama is hopeful change, John, I think you dispelled it in your article. And I've got it on my desktop right now, From Kennedy to Obama, Liberalism's Last Fling.
Yeah.
I think anybody who thinks that Obama is a liberalist or a populist is living in a fantasy land.
Well, I think that, you know, the world has been through too much to accept, at best, this kind of naivety that people have and wish to indulge themselves with. Okay, he's the first African American to...
John, let me interrupt you because that music means you're going to cut us off for a break.
If you write that down on paper, that's pretty spectacular. But it's not so spectacular, frankly, when you think about the kind of system which he embodies.
Welcome back to the NewsHour. I'm Steve Lindman. I'm on with John Pilcher. I think we still have a connection problem, Gary.
Yeah.
Can you hear me okay, John?
No. Probably a good idea to call me back when you've got it all clear there, Steve. You've got a chorus of heavenly angels with you at the moment, and that's very nice, but I don't think we can do an interview like that.
Oh, the music is for a commercial break.
Yeah, I can barely hear you,
bring us back on, John.
I can barely hear you. That's the point. I'm
speaking. Why don't you hang up and we'll call back and see if we can get a better line, a better connection. Will it? Okay. Give it another try, Gary. Hopefully we can do it. The joys of live radio. We were talking about Barack Obama, all of the convention activities that wrapped up last week. And John wrote about Barack Obama last spring. I've written about him a couple of times, and I just put out an article today that I call Vying to be Toughest, essentially talking about both candidates and their running mates, absolutely embracing an agenda of permanent wars. The official policy of the U.S. is to use first-strike nuclear weapons against any nature if we so choose to do so. There certainly are nations in our target sites right now, the possibility of a conflict against Iran, the recent problems, crisis in the Caucasus, with Georgia being used as a U.S. proxy, attacking the independent breakaway province, a republic of South Ossetia. Washington very definitely behind that. Georgia would never get into a conflict with Russia. And, John, are we doing better this time?
No, you're not, Steve. I can barely hear you.
Oh, I can hear you fine.
I can't hear you very well, so that's not going to make for a conversation.
Why don't I turn you loose and let you talk about Obama and our presidential politics?
Steve, it's very difficult to, you know, the last time I answered a question to you, I found myself talking into a commercial. The technical side of it, I think I should leave to you guys over there to get right, but I'd rather do it when you've got it right.
Well, I don't know what to suggest. The tech side is out of my hands.
Yeah.
Gary? Well, we will do the best that we can. Again, getting into presidential politics, an agenda of permanent wars. I'm afraid I did not make my distinguished guest very happy. I hope we can reconnect, and I hope we can get a good, clear line so we can have a good discussion. This is not what I had in mind this morning, but there is so much going on, and it should scare people because it's a very disturbing situation. You need to read between the lines of what the candidates are saying. Take a very good, hard look at, number one, who these people are, who they represent, what the agenda is. I can assure you it's a continuation of the last 8 years. And the last 8 years were a continuation of decade after decade after decade. This is not something that's new. The Bush administration didn't spring up out of nowhere and suddenly decide that it would take on the world and make us supreme above all others. This has been an agenda since at least back to World War II. And it's progressed incrementally over time. And very definitely, this country has an agenda to be unchallengeable in power, to really reign supreme over all other countries, to take on any outliers that would dare to challenge our supremacy, and to either convince them that they need to roll over for us or risk the possibility of a made in Washington coup d'etat, an assassination, and if it comes to it, declaring war on them using some contrived reason like WMDs that don't exist in Iraq, claiming Iran is a threat to its neighbors, is developing nuclear weapons. Oh, dear, John, I deeply apologize to you. Is it better?
That's all right. Steve, I just want to hear you. Now I can not very well, but I can hear you, so that's okay.
I sincerely, sincerely apologize. The tech side is completely out of my hands, and
yeah.
I must say this has not happened before.
Yeah.
So I'm sitting here with egg on my face, and I hope we can keep this going and have a good discussion.
Okay. Steve, I've got about half an hour, if that's okay.
Oh, that's okay. That's fine.
Yeah, fine.
Let's jump back into what you wrote about on Obama and maybe just broaden it into the whole campaign and the fact that we have two parties that really represent the same agenda.
I think that's correct. I think what has happened in certainly during the Bush years and in which followed on from the Clinton years and the Reagan years, I think what has happened as a result of those political times is that a machine, an ideological machine, has really been built very effectively. It hasn't been built only by Bush. I think the Clinton years played as much, if not more, as great a role, if not a great, as Bush in building this. I was going to say consensus, but it's more, as I would say, an ideological machine in which there are now certain premises, certain presuppositions that are rigid. And I don't see any interference in the progress of that machine coming from the Democrats. On the contrary, I think that the Democrats will play almost a traditional role of going along with it. So, in other words, it's almost as if the die has been cast, and everything that Obama has said, and his supporters may say that he's backtracked, but I don't think he's backtracked. I think he probably has always believed this. Everything he's said in the last 2 months or so really is not all that different from what McCain is saying. He wants to, as he said, and I quote him, to build a 21st century military, to stay on the offensive everywhere from Djibouti, which is in Africa, to Kandahar, which is in Afghanistan. He promises more bombs and bullets and aircrafts. He's threatened to attack Pakistan. He regards the new governments, or the new movements in Latin America, as a threat. He says he will continue the embargo on Cuba and so on and so forth. I don't see this as a great deal of change. In fact, it's no change at all. I think it's very important that people take the stars out of their eyes and really understand this.
Oh, I agree with you totally, John. I think this agenda goes back at least to the World War II years, when my country went into that war intending to come out of it as the supreme world power. And we were lucky because there was no way that the U.S. mainland could be attacked at that time. Certainly isn't true anymore. And we very definitely were the only world power left standing when that war was over. I even see the Cold War as awfully fraudulent. Soviet Russia was so decimated by World War II, it took, maybe a decade and a half, 2 decades, for them even to get back to be the semblance of a normal country. How could they ever imagine attacking anybody else? But they had nuclear weapons, so that made them a threat, It kept our military-industrial complex roaring, John, as we both know, by claiming there was this great threat. And then the awesome fear when the Soviet Union dissolved in 1991, we didn't have a decent enemy around anymore. We had to invent a new one. Enter Saddam.
Yeah, well, I think that's all true. But I think it is all true, but I think certainly any room to maneuver coming from those who would dissent with, let's say, the establishment in the United States, I think that space to maneuver, however slight, was closed. Closed really very effectively during the Clinton years. And I suppose my point is that when there is the promise of change, as there was with the beginning of the Clinton years in 92, that's the time when dissenting voices within a society can be co-opted, seduced, and silenced.
That music means they're going to take a break.
Oh.
Let's take it and come back, and I'll let you pick right up.
All right.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. I'm on with John Pilger. John, can you stay about another 15 minutes?
Sure.
Okay. They break on the half hour, and then around 20
all
minutes
right.
up to the top of the next hour, we can cut it off, and I can handle it from there. I agree with you fully on what you're saying. I guess things went into a higher gear during the Reagan years. And then the Clinton years and the Democratic Leadership Council agenda basically continued the neoliberal policies that began during the 1980s.
Yeah. Well, I think that's right. I think there was, I think with the end of the Carter period, very powerful forces in the United States decided that the vulnerability brought about by Vietnam and Watergate, and indeed by, as they saw it, Jimmy Carter, they decided that would never happen again. And they moved with expedient ruthlessness during the Reagan period. And, of course, then we had the one period of George H.W. Bush, but I suppose my interest is in the illusions that people have about change, and by having these illusions, they really do hold back change, I think. We've been through that. As you rightly point out, we went through it going right back to post-World War II, but we went through it with Clinton, the promise even of health care in the United States. Hillary Clinton's project was of course, didn't turn to anything. And the destruction of the last New Deal safety nets in the United States, and the violence in foreign policy that extended from the various invasions of Haiti and through to Yugoslavia, and with the dreadful background of the embargo, the lethal embargo imposed on Iraq during the 1990s, with all of that, that really set the scene for the Bush years. There's nothing that Obama has said
that indicates he will turn back any of that. His selection of Joe Biden, you know, a man absolutely given to the more extremes of foreign policy, including unqualified support for Israel's occupation of Palestine. His selection of Biden really indicates that. As for the other pair, well, I mean, I suppose it's too easy to say they're cartoon figures, but they are. But they're very dangerous cartoon figures. I think those great forces of change, the people who go into the streets, the people that have gone to the conventions, have had to put up with the most terrible police harassment, and I think that there has to be a realization that there aren't any allies for the forces of change among those running for the president. I think once people realize that, then the way ahead then is understood. But if it's not understood, I suppose my point is that it can only be blunted.
John, I get frustrated and I wonder how many times do people need to be fooled to finally realize that we have a two-party duopoly. They represent hardline interests, totally subservient to a pro-corporate agenda. Militarism writ large now. The Bush neocons really began it. And even Obama, I don't know if he's his chief foreign policy advisor, but certainly a very important one, Zbigniew Brzezinski.
Yeah.
He's not keen on the Iraq war, not because he doesn't want to control Iraq and the great oil resources. His scope is just much larger, which he wrote about in his 1997 book, The Grand Chessboard. All of Eurasia, which includes the Middle East and the Asian subcontinent and all of Russia and China and the Caucasus crisis that erupted in early August, that is a big deal. That is a very, very big deal. And it could signal that we're back into a second Cold War, and we've got a real potentially dangerous confrontation ahead of us between us and Russia. And, of course, both countries are very heavily armed with nuclear weapons. My goodness, what if a mistake is made and we get into an accidental nuclear war? It's very scary to think about this prospect.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's right. And that's why the people who are still feared, I think, by the establishments in the United States and in this country and other societies, the people who organize and go onto the streets, such as the nuclear freeze movement that filled the center of Manhattan with a million people back in the early 80s, and all the other great movements of dissent. I think we've got to come back to that.
Let's take a break, John, and we'll pick it up for about another 10 minutes, then I'll let you go.
Okay.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. I'm on with John Pilger. John, I like to think that there are three nations that are linked in a very, very dangerous triumvirate. Your country, the UK. I guess your adopted country. You're a native Australian living in London. The U.S. is the lead player, and the third one being Israel. And the U.S. and Israel have no compunctions about going to war against anybody, and the U.K. seems to not at all be shy about supporting them and joining in Iraq and Afghanistan, who knows where else. And it's just a very, very dangerous three-nation combination that is placing the world at very, very great risk. all three nuclear powers.
Well, I would add to that the European Union, which of which, of course, the UK is part, and the UK is the most aggressive, it seems, member of the UK, of the European Union. But the European Union plays a very important, what we say these days, passive-aggressive role in maintaining the rapacious economic order around the world by demanding the lowering of tariff barriers in poor countries, and by and maintaining its own fortress and going along with sanctions against Iraq and the bellicose rhetoric against Russia, and of course staffing, as many of them do, NATO.
And bellicose rhetoric against Iran too, and you just wrote about that a month ago.
Yeah, so I would think that the European Union plays almost as great a role in this. There is undoubtedly a struggle of imperial forces in the world between the European Union, the United States, China, and Russia. The competition for oil and for access to oil, which is access to oil, has a great deal to do with the problems in the Caucasus. These are as old as empires, or as old as modern empires, and we're seeing them played out now in a quite a desperate way as hydrocarbons and oil and so on start to seriously deplete, and as the U.S. economy it goes from bad to worse, it is, as you say, a very dangerous time. But a great power that we all have is that of understanding and information. There is quite a lot of information around these days. We're speaking on your program, which is a source of that information. There's information on the internet. There is a kind of technological word of mouth now. So there isn't really any excuse for those people, as many people who are really worried about these developments, not to inform themselves and to take action.
I agree with you so strongly, John. People need to just make a very modest effort. And I like to say things like, it's wonderful to be informed, but that really isn't the issue. The issue is that there are very, very dangerous things going on in the world, and our individual welfare is at stake. We need... Are we back, John? Can you hear me?
There it is again. Okay, I got
it. Can you hear me, John?
The connection is going up and down. All right, I think we're maybe near the end now. We're very difficult to hear you.
Oh yeah, John, we are near the end, and you've been very, very gracious to me hearing through this technical problems. I must tell you, this is the first time this has happened to me.
Yeah.
So I'm deeply embarrassed and
deeply
offer my sincerest apologies.
You may be, there may be something sinister at work here. Who knows?
You never can tell. I think they know about us, John. If they want to muck us up, they certainly can do it very easily.
Well, they haven't mucked us up. We've got our words out, and that's the main thing.
John, we got an awful lot of it out, and I know you have to go, and I don't want to keep you any longer. I'll continue talking about what you have brought up, and my very, very great thanks to you for coming on. You are one of my great heroes. Can I ask you one final question? Are you working on a new book?
I'm not working on a book at the moment, but I am starting to think about another film about the media and war. That's probably going to be the next project.
You put a notice out when and if something is available.
I will indeed.
Certainly spread the word, John. You have my word on that.
Okay, but I'd like to thank you for the terrific work you do. It's so important, and you know, well done to all your listeners who hear you and are loyal to you.
John, whatever little I do, it's the inspiration of from people like you that inspire me to do whatever I'm able to do. We need to marshal a lot of us together to take on a very, very big project.
I agree with that.
John, I will let you go, and again, my very, very great thanks and sincere apologies for the technical problems.
All power to you, Steve.
Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. John Pilger. I didn't say it to him on air, but for a very long time I've considered him the premier journalist in the world. He's been at it the longest, I think, of most anybody doing it. He's scrupulously honest. He takes on very tough issues. He's a documentary filmmaker. He's an author of 10 books. He's a prolific writer of many, many articles. He travels the world. He's got many films that are available, documentary films that are available online, and his website. I think if you Google his name, John Pilger, I think it's johnpilger.com, but if you Google John Pilger, you will see his website. You can go to it. You can see the books that he's written. You can find the documentary films that he's made on all sorts of topics, going back through the years, Vietnam, occupied Palestine, nuclear power, so much that John addresses, and he does it so brilliantly and eloquently, and we need a lot more people like him, but there are too few like him around, very, very sadly. I had him on another program that I hosted over a year ago, and it was a wonderful session that we had together. Unfortunately, we have the tech problems this time. I feel bad about that. But let me just pick up. He made some very important points, and I stress them in my writing and discussions on air on this program. The very, very serious situation we find ourselves in right now, we have a combination of again, I call it, others have called it, I call it also a two-party duopoly. There's barely a dime's worth of difference between them, and it almost doesn't matter which candidate wins. I think given a choice between the two, Obama certainly is no worse than John McCain, and his vice presidential choice, who I had a line in my latest article out today, vying to be toughest, a line about her saying she's only notable for having been chosen. She really is a no-name nobody, but the media are playing her to the hilt, making her into an instant celebrity. The AP on a report over the weekend even talked about the McCain-Palin ticket becoming the Palin-McCain ticket, if you can imagine something so ludicrous. Here's a woman who's been governor of a very small state, maybe a fourth the size of the city of Chicago that I live in population, 680,000 people, Chicago a few million. Before that, she was the mayor of a town that now has a population of about 9,500 people. When she was mayor, I think it was about half that population. My goodness, the neighborhood I live in has that many people, and we have an alderman who represents us in my neighborhood. A very ordinary kind of guy, whoever it might be. Before that, she was on the PTA, but most important is what she believes in. I covered things that she went public on before she was chosen as a vice presidential candidate, she never had a reason to take a stand on war and peace or free trade or various other issues that did not concern her, being governor of Alaska. But she was very, very definitely pro the big oil companies and drilling everywhere in sight. Most dangerous. The reason that she was chosen has got nothing to do with her qualifications. It's to get somebody to please the most extremist elements in the Republican Party, including the very, very radical Christian right, very accurately characterized as the as Christian fascists. And they've been written about in those terms, and I've certainly written a little bit over time in some of my writings characterizing that way. They are very, very dangerous extremist people. They believe in the agenda of the Bush administration, permanent wars, going after anybody and getting rid of all of our opposition to make the U.S. supreme and unchallengeable, and ruling very harshly over whoever might stand in our way. Getting rid of all social services, letting everybody fend for themselves, ending civil liberties. These are very dangerous policies. This is what this woman believes in. She was affiliated with an extremist Alaskan party. I don't have the name of it in front of me. Remember the initials. The initials were AIP. I'd never heard of it before until I discovered it only days ago. She's affiliated with them. They have some very, very odd beliefs, including separatism, separating Alaska from the rest of the U.S. Well, it means never should have been joined in the first place. There is a geographic separation, but it's not one of the 50 states. I don't know that I'm all that keen about having a state separate. I don't think I'd be too keen on having Illinois separate. I'm not certain what difference it would make if the state did. But she believes in that. But she believes in the very hard fascist-leaning agenda of this party. She may be an attractive woman, a form of... I believe she was a Miss Alaska state finalist going back 20-odd years. I think we know what McCain stands for. He is extremely militarist. I've said it a couple of times in my writing that he even scares some in the Pentagon, if that's possible. And of all people, I quoted Pat Buchanan in my latest article, who said, McCain makes Cheney look like Gandhi. Now imagine a comment like that. I would not go that far. I would never equate Dick Cheney with Mahatma Gandhi, a man of peace, a great man of peace. But Cheney is a very dangerous man. John McCain is a very dangerous man. The Republicans are a very dangerous party, but very sadly the Democrats aren't much better. I can assure listeners that no matter who gets elected in November, we face an agenda of permanent global wars on terrorism. Terrorism is one of the operative words. The only way these people can get away with this is to scare the public, make the majority of people believe there really is a threat out there, and the people who go to Washington to represent us are there to protect us. Well, they are not there to protect us. They are there to harm us. They're there to remove our civil liberties, take away the last remaining remnants of our social benefits. They are very rapidly disappearing, and the two gold standard ones that are left, they absolutely are committed to ending them, and those two are Social Security and Medicare. They are bedrock things that most people in the country rely on. I certainly do. I spent a working lifetime contributing to both. I'd be mortified if they were taken away from me. I don't think that the scheme is to take them away from people like me. The scheme is to see that young people with a good number of working years left before they reach retirement never get these benefits. Medicare and Social Security both have done a great deal of ending poverty for a large segment of the senior population. If these end, then there simply is no safety net. There's nothing for people to fall back on. You've got that. You've got the whole range of repressive laws that were passed post 9/11. I wrote a year-end article last year called Police State America, very dramatic title, but it simply is incontrovertible that that's what we are. I simply went through the laws that have been passed since the 9/11 event, the various executive orders and so-called Homeland Security and National Security presidential directives, some of them so extreme, so dangerous. One of them referred to a continuity of government, meaning in case of a national emergency that literally could be anything the administration says it is. It could be an environmental catastrophe. It could be a so-called terrorist attack, real or contrived. It could be anything. And a national emergency is declared, and it's followed by ending the Constitution. It's virtually stripped bare now, but ending constitutional rights, declaring martial law in the name of national security, and creating an extra constitutional government, or a super constitutional government, where the rule of law no longer applies. It barely applies now, U.S. law or international law, but it would be made official, and this, whatever the scheme might be, if it ever happens, would be such that people would be terrified enough to go along with it, thinking that whatever the government will do will protect it. The same idea as post 9/11. We have a final break coming up, and I'll finish up with some final comments before we get to the second hour. I'll tell you about to my guests in the second hour as well. Welcome back. Final few minutes of the news hour. I know there's a caller on the line. I just want to mention one thing about my guest in the next hour. A very remarkable, dedicated woman. Her name is Angana Chatterjee. She's a South Asian expert. We'll talk about a very big story that gets almost no coverage, even in the alternative media. It's about violence going on in India that in many respects rivals what is going on in Iraq. We'll get into it in the second hour. I hope you'll stay tuned. It's extraordinary, and it took for me to hear another interview with Angana on another program to educate me as to just how extreme this is in a country most people think of as a normal democracy. Well, it is not, and if you stay tuned, I think you will be shocked at what you hear. Do we have Marilyn on the line?
Yes, hi. Thank you for
your... Hi, Marilyn. Happy to have you on.
Thank you. I appreciate your taking my call. I'm concerned because of some of the things you have equated, it seemed to equate Bible-believing Christianity with fascism and with George Bush and this Sarah Palin. I would like to tell you that I am a Bible-believing Christian. I do not support George Bush. In fact, I don't support any political entities. I believe that what you and Mr. Pilger and others say are true, that our country is trying to establish a world government and is fomenting crisis and killing people worldwide. I do not believe that is what Christ taught or what the Bible teaches, but I really get concerned when people equate George Bush or even Obama or some of these people as Christians and their behavior as trying to establish world government via biblical Christianity. It's false, and it gives Christians, it sets us up for the same kind of persecution we received under, say, Nero in the early years after Christ died.
I agree with you totally, and maybe I didn't make myself clear. I'm only talking about a fringe element of extremist Christians. You've got the same thing in Judaism, the same thing in Islam, the same thing in Hinduism. We'll talk about it in the next hour. These people do not represent the majority of people in their religions. Most of them are people like you. You're God-fearing, but you're not a warrior. You don't want to go to war with everybody.
Well, I believe the Bible, and the Bible very clearly says the war is not ours, it is Jesus Christ. So it would be stupid for me to go against that. I wouldn't be a real Christian if I did that. and certainly not George Bush or Obama or Clinton or any of these people, who some of them proclaim, and George Bush had a book out with an angelic halo over his head claiming to be a Christ, and many people that are atheists or agnostics equate this with Christianity, and this is a very sophisticated brainwashing effort that our government is undertaking to do this and demonize Christianity.
Well, there's no question, and I say to myself, people like George Bush claims to be a good Christian, and I say, I happen to be Jewish, and I was taught the Ten Commandments, and I believe very fervently in love thy neighbor, and thou shalt not kill, and do unto others. And I don't know how anybody can call themselves a good Jew, Christian, Muslim, if they think that killing and wars are a fine thing to do. That is very un-Christian, very un-Jewish, very un-Islam, it creates an immense hypocrisy.
Well, but a lot of us are not fooled by Sarah Palin either. I just want you to know. I think that any woman who claims to be pro-life, which I am, and has all those kids and still wants to be vice president, there's something really wrong somewhere.
She worries me. She and all the others worry me. Marilyn, it looks like we're out of time.
Thank you.
I thank you for your comments, and I emphasize, I agree with you.
Good.